Hello and welcome to edition 368 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On the show today, we'll be discussing the art collection of a man with noted exquisite taste, David Bowie. Simon Hucker from auction house Sotheby's will be explaining its new exhibition and forthcoming auction, Bowie Collector.
Then Robert and I will be getting a crash course in jazz, cabaret and opera with Australian soprano and singer Ali McGregor. We'll see if Rob has a second career option a little later in the show.
And finally, we'll be taking a trip to the Rhône region in France using art and food to get us there. Chef Adam Rawson and curator Joel Karamath will be talking us through the University of the Arts in London's new exhibit, The Rhône Touch, at the end of the show.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be serving some top stories too in the news look ahead, and we'll play some new music as well. That's right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Here we are, Andrew. It's lunchtime. Our tummies are rumbling, but nonetheless, we've manned up and we've manned the studio. How has been your week? It's been summery in London. Have you enjoyed that? Had your shorts on most of the week?
I did have my shorts on most of the week.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I can't complain about the heat after so many kind of miserable kind of rainy days.
Yeah.
You can kind of you can forget all your woes when there's a bit of sunshine out.
You can forget your woes when the sunshine is out. When it's warm outside, it's beautiful. I think that I'm a solar-powered person, much like you. We're not necessarily sun worshippers, but we do love it. I think maybe we have lizard's tendencies to lie upside down on our backs in the sunshine. But it's not without its politics, is it, the sun? In the office, there is a warm side of the office and a cool side of the office. We're on the cool side.
So we like the windows open.
We like the windows open. Some people like to have the aircon on. I don't know whether our listeners loathe the air conditioning as much as we do. Clearly, there are people listening in places like Singapore where, you know, you kind of need your aircon. But if you're on this side of the world, it's really, they should take it out of all offices, I think.
But it does make it complicated when you come to work in your shorts and then suddenly there's a draft around your knees.
It's freezing.
Now, if you want to keep cool this summer, the other thing is, get your copy of The Escapist. It's on newsstands now. It's rather nice. You can use it as a fan. You can use it to wedge open a door, or you could read it.
Where did you go for The Escapist? The Escapist is in all good news agents now, I believe, isn't it?
I went to the Azores.
You went to the Azores, yeah.
1,500 kilometres from the mainland of Portugal. And a little bit windswept.
And even when you say the mainland, you mean Portugal as well.
Well, you do, so it's a long way. It's Portugal. The strange thing is, when I just sent some copies to some of the nice people I met, and yeah. You write the address and you put Azores, Portugal, and you think, it's a long, long
I hope
way.
It's going to get there.
Yeah, it's a long way away. But yeah, I had a great time and intriguing, interesting, bit wet on occasion, but exciting. And you got to do.
I basically went on holiday, which I thought was the point of The Escapist, actually. It's about going on holiday. I don't know if yours was quite a holiday. Yours was more of a piece of journalism than just, here's what I did, or a postcard.
You took a mate and a jag.
A mate and a jag, drove from Biarritz to Marseille through the Pyrenees, did some of those grueling Tour de France climbs, but yeah, in a big cat. It's quite fun.
Good. Well, I think everyone should read it. It's our kind of exploration of places less discovered, less explored over the horizon. 10 of them, plus some other nice bits too. And as we said, both us and Robert Bound appear on the pages. Anyway, I should be working for a news agent, shouldn't I?
You could be doing voice. You could do the bit of terms and conditions apply that they do on radio advertising. Terms and conditions apply. Shall we? When it comes to terms and conditions applying, the small print, the bits that you kind of don't necessarily need, the bits that have the crunched up bits of cereal in the bottom of the packet. It reminds me of only one man and his news look ahead. It's Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry.
Hi, Henry.
Hello. Sorry, I'm just adjusting my pop shield. There we are.
Yeah, no. Take your hands out your trousers. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
What's going to be happening next week? How's your week been?
It's been good. Thank you. Yeah. Hot, as you mentioned. I was an early adopter of the shorts last year. I'm wearing trousers today.
Yeah, just having a look.
So, you know, you've got to mix it up sometimes.
Yeah. You can have too much of a good thing, can't you?
It is possible. It is possible. But no, I actually, in the heat, I have, my legs are the least of my concern because I'm a cyclist, as you know.
Yeah. So you're used to having them out.
And I suffer from, I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, but I suffer from an extremely sweaty back. I can't think of any other way of putting it.
When I
commute in.
Is it because you've got a rucksack?
It's because, I haven't. So I've been meaning to invest in a pannier for a long time.
That's good.
I don't like panniers.
I've not got around to it. And it's got so bad in the last week, I've actually been changing when I've come in.
Yeah?
Yeah, Some people
used to utilise the showering facilities on the ground
floor. I wouldn't do that. I'm not a savage.
But no chafing?
Luckily, no chafing, no. I seem to have been spared that particular...
What's wrong with a pannier?
Affliction.
You don't like that? It's a bit smart.
That's why. No, it's just when. What happens when you go for like dinner and then you kind of arrive in a restaurant? And you've got like you always look like a two cyclist. I think when you arrive for dinner and you've got like panniers and helmets.
You can buy quite elegant ones now. You can buy quite ones that look less like kind of waterproof messenger bags. So
okay, okay, I'll forgive them.
I don't mind a pannier. I like all the kinds of French bread.
Sure.
Anyway, give us some news, for God's sake. That's what you're here.
Next week, the big event, of course, off the back of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland last week, is the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
Which is taking place in Philadelphia, which I think is the city of brotherly love. Is that its...
Is it?
I think so.
Okay.
It's where Rocky was shot too, isn't it?
Yeah, big time.
It's where Philadelphia was shot as well. And the Philadelphia Story.
and presumably...
And the Philadelphia cheese spread ad as well.
I was going to get around to the cheese spread. The soft cheese spread, probably the most important iteration of that word.
What now, actually happened? So we had the Republican one this week, just gone, and Trump gave a sort of 75-minute sort of proper actual speech.
Yes, but
and
we...
Does this have an official reason, these things? Or is this just a back-slapping exercise?
So basically, it is the kind of official function of these events is it's the point at which normally the winner of the primary season accepts the formal nomination of the party. But there have been instances in the past, which I'm sorry to say, I'm not informed enough to be able to give a rundown of them now, where actually there have been kind of coups, small coups in the convention, and people have snagged the nomination from the jaws of defeat by corralling the right people in the convention. But yeah, this should be, I mean...
There's been a lot of this, hasn't there? In US politics, there's a lot of things that you think are the important thing, but they're not. They're just something on the way to the important thing.
Precisely.
Right? I mean, this seems to be going on for aeons.
Right. It's on geologic time.
Jesus.
But, I mean, it's difficult to imagine the Democrats hamming this up. Hamming? Is that a
you
right
can
phrase?
Ham it, yeah.
Faffing this up any worse than the Republicans, who, of course, I think on each separate night of the convention had a cock up of some sort.
Okay.
Trump's wife in the first on the first night, obviously plagiarizing Michelle Obama's speech at the 2008 National Convention, and then Ted Cruz failing to endorse Trump. Although there have been, so obviously you know, there's also a rift within the Democratic Party between supporters of Bernie Sanders and supporters of Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's going to come to accept the party's nomination here. There are already people predicting that there might be some discord in the ranks of the Democratic delegates there, some staunch Trump supporters causing trouble. Six people were arrested on Wednesday, last Wednesday, for staging a pro-Sanders sit-in at the Democratic HQ in the city. So things could heat up.
Okay. Well, we shall watch that space.
Please do.
That big old space.
And, of course, listeners can follow the coverage of the event on Monocle 24 throughout the week, I should mention.
Thank you.
We've got a website.
Moving on.
Okay.
Monocle.com.
Okay. I'm only joking.
I think forward slash radio.
I know what we do. It's fine. Come on.
The 24th of July, the Rio Olympic Village opens for athletes.
Sounds camp, doesn't it?
Now, do you think...
Olympic Village sounds a bit funny to me. Do you know what I mean?
It's a bit like a toy village.
No, but it's the Olympic Village. I don't know. It just sounds funny to me. It sounds a bit like a children's TV programme.
The Olympic Village. The Rio Olympic Village.
It
could be. It's opening its doors to welcome athletes who will participate in the Rio Olympics. Among them will not be a considerable cohort of Russian athletes, as we know this week.
Yeah.
Because of the kind of shocking, but kind of not shocking, centralised doping scandal in that country, which the IOC has come down on.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Hard.
It really
it's
is.
Not good, is it?
No.
Doesn't inspire you with confidence. And sorry, Andrew, you're looking
to say
something.
No, I agree with you. But then you do imagine that there are probably one or two clean athletes in Russia whose like only hope of ever appearing at Olympics will be taken away from them. And also, you do wonder when you look at some other sports, you know, not centralised in this way, but you do begin to, after what we saw in cycling, for example, you wonder how many of these sports are kind of riven with, you know, with cheating on a scale that we just don't know about. Because that's the interesting thing, that so many of these drugs that were being used and you know, and switching blood and all sorts of things, they were hard for people to spot in the past.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, if you look at the last kind of even year, it's not been a golden age for international sporting organisations, has it? I mean, we've had everything to do with FIFA. The Rio Olympics have not been planned particularly well. And, you know, aside from the threat from Zika, you know, there are serious infrastructural problems. The IOC have been struggling with how to handle it.
I think there's a great case to be made for actually sport at the highest level being not being sport at the lowest level. Like, actually, if you really want to watch something, watch like the second or third division of that sport, because actually it's kind of fair. It's quite good quality, and you can afford to get in and see it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think actually the high.
It embodies the values of sportsmanship.
Yeah, I think more. As soon as you get high up in these things, whatever form of sport it's in, it gets rubbish. It gets crooked. It gets over sponsored. You lose the kind of heart.
Power corrupts. That's what you're saying, Rob.
Yeah, I do. I just think these bodies are full of crooks. You know, FIFA and the Olympic Committee aren't exactly as clear as the pure driven snow, are they?
No,
it seems to me.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think that's been proven to be the case.
Indeed.
I think. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, on the 24th of July, the same day of the Olympic Village opens, it's International Bog Day.
Oh, God.
International Bog Day, established in Scotland in 1991, is celebrated throughout Northern Europe, Canada, and the USA. Now, I know that, Andrew, am I right in assuming
been in a bog.
You're familiar with bogs. No, but you're a bit of an amateur ornithologist.
What are you suggesting?
What is this? Is it you mixing these two stories together and talking about drug taking and someone never being out of a bog?
Bogs are actually a remarkable natural assets, Rob, I'll have you know. They occur when peat, water and plants have been growing together for 10,000 years. That's the technical definition of a bog habitat.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They're under threat. The exploitation of peat for fuel has dramatically reduced the area once covered by peatlands.
Mm.
I should say this is in Ireland. This is from the Irish Peatland Conservation Council's press release to promote International Bog Day.
What's the point of this day, though? Is that to raise awareness and don't dig them up? Don't chuck.
Quoting from the statement, the annual event has been designed to celebrate the beauty of bogs and to help make people more aware of peatlands, the services they provide for free, and the threats they face.
Well, because the trouble is, they keep on getting sold, and if you buy one, you often get given another one for free.
That's
for
right.
Very nice indeed. Very nice. Andrew's on fire today.
Okay.
Anyway, there's all our listeners. See ya. Not you, Henry.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Henry Sheridan, for bringing in all your damp news. And get your galoshes on. Go. Goodbye. David Bowie was a singular presence in the artistic landscape, and his death earlier this year left a hole that many music fans are still wondering how to fill. But as well as the countless hits, he left the world something else too, an art collection. In November this year, Sotheby's will stage Bowie Collector, a three-part sale comprising over 400 items from the private collection. But as well as countless hits, he left the world something else too, an art collection. In November this year, Sotheby's will stage Bowie Collector, a three-part sale comprising over 400 items from his collection. His eye for contemporary art includes over 200 works by artists such as Frank Auerbach, Henry Moore, Graham Sutherland and Damien Hirst.
Before the sale in November, though, Sotheby's will send the works on a short travelling exhibition which kicked off in London this week. It'll be on show at Sotheby's until the 9th of August before heading to New York, Los Angeles and Hong Kong. Joining us now to tell us how Bowie picked his pieces is Simon Hucker, Director of Modern and Postwar British Art at Sotheby's. Simon, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
First of all, this is a nice project to have come across your door, isn't it? I mean, all the stuff that comes through Sotheby's doors is of undisputable quality, but this has got a great story to it. Tell us how this kind of came about.
Well, I mean, for me, as somebody who specialises in modern and post-war British art, this is an exciting collection in itself. It's got great works by all of the kind of most significant artists of the 20th century, but the fact that it belongs to David Bowie as well just gives it that extra...
It gives it a veneer of quality and interest, I suppose, as well.
Right? Yeah, but he was a really serious art collector. He didn't really have advisors. He worked with a couple of people that he trusted, but on the whole, he read a lot. He taught himself. He'd used his eye, most importantly, and obviously, you know, looking at his music, looking at his influence on Stalin. He's a guy with great taste, and he allied that with learning about people, and he put together a really fantastic collection.
And tell me, what did he buy? Because I've heard some people say that what's interesting is it's not an outrageous collection, that he was often going after British artists, post-war, as you say, who were great of their time and their ilk, but they weren't the outrageous performance side that we saw of him as well.
Yeah, I think that was a real appeal for him. He's interested in outsiders. You can see that in some of his music. And so for him, in the history of 20th century art, British art is a little bit outside. You know, people talk about American abstract expressionism, but they don't talk about what was going on in Britain at the same time. And often a lot of our artists were involved in international movements. They showed at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. They were part of that, but they don't seem to get written about these days. So he liked the idea that British art was a little bit obscure, but obviously, you know, he's British, so it's a way of him coming home at the same time.
Do you know when he bought these pictures, for example? Is he buying pieces as he meets people, as, you know, as he comes through his whole career? Was he collecting art and buying pieces here and there? Is he buying from friends? How did he amass the collection?
It's unclear when he started to put this collection together, but it seems to be late 1980s, early 1990s. It's a quite intense period of collecting, probably running, early 90s. And he pieced it together bit by bit. He'd get interested in one artist, and so he'd read about the other artists who worked in the same place at the same time. So he gets interested in St Ives, which for most people is just a small fishing village on the edge of Cornwall, but actually in the post-war period was the hotbed of avant-garde painting. And so he goes down to St Ives. He went on a trip.
LA before LA, wasn't it? Right? All that light.
So he goes down there and he gets a feel for the place, he gets a feel for where the art's coming from. And then he would buy stuff by Peter Lanyon, Wilhelmina Barnes Graham, Winifred Nicholson, artists who are working in that area.
And it's one of those things, when whole collections come up for auction, that's amazing. That's balm to the vanity of the collector, but also the auction house. It's a wonderful thing. Does this feel, and people collect for different reasons, people collect for investment, people collect in a very scholarly way, people collect the canon. Would you have been able to attach this collection to Bowie if you didn't know it was his? I wonder if you can see facets of his personality in the stuff he collected, just even in the Bowie in the popular conscious.
I think initially you don't. It seems very Bowie-like in the way he's interested in. But then as you start to see the connections within the collection, you see little linkages and the clever little twists and turns, it starts to feel quite Bowie-esque. The fact that it's very layered, the fact that it's very surprising. And there are certain artists that he was into who you can see very obvious connections. So he collects outsider art, you know, art made by the inmates of the Guggen Psychiatric Institute in Vienna. So that whole thing about outsiders and being strange, it's there. There's works by Jean-Michel Basquiat, who
played Warhol in the film.
Exactly,
Basquiat,
and I think he bought the Basquiat after working on that film. But he also knew about Basquiat. He knew, if you're interested in expression, in outsiderness, he was the outsider of the New York
art. And sexuality and all these things that were part of that conversation.
So there's lots of things within the collection which do, you can see where it might then have influenced his music or how his music might have influenced his art collecting.
And how on earth? So this is a travelling show as well. Yeah. So this is in London at the moment. As we said, it hops on the bus and whizzes all over the world. I mean, there's 200 pieces in this collection. What do you choose to take on the road? A sort of cross section, or what you might think are the most saleable international pieces?
Yeah, it's difficult. Yeah. Normally for a highlight show, it's usually the most valuable objects because it costs a huge amount of money to travel them around the world. But we felt it was very important with this collection to try and represent the texture and the diversity of it. So a lot of the things that are on exhibition now in London, and which will travel to New York, to LA, to Hong Kong, they're not expensive things, but they're significant in the context of the collection. So it's hard to boil down 300, 400 works into 30-odd works, but we've tried to just capture the main themes, some of the main pieces, of course, but also the little sort of diverse areas that he was interested in.
You say it's not a particularly expensive collection in a sense, but when you come to doing a valuation, when you're an auction house, is there a premium attached for ownership in this case?
Yeah, provenance is interesting.
Provenance usually within auctions is important. Collectors of art like the idea that the person who owned it before was either famous for their taste, for their collection, or well known. There's lots of things like that. But actually, when we value the collection, we were very, very careful not to add in a Bowie factor. The prices we put on them would be the prices we would put on them if anybody brought them in, if they belonged to anybody. I mean, there happened to be...
I suppose it being an auction, their Bowie factor will come in the before room, the hammer the, goes
yeah,
down,
yeah.
possibly.
Yeah, right? possibly. I mean, yeah. I'm sure it will for certain things, but it's...
Who have you got on the case? Who's doing the auction?
Oliver Barker's going to be
He'll get them going, won't he? Yeah. Come on. I bet you he'll say the words Bowie factor. Come on.
we're not sure, but that's the exciting thing about it. And actually, we've kind of been holding it in for a few months, and we announced it very recently. And actually, the exhibition that's on now is our first chance we could really show people a certain amount of what's in the collection. And already, just as soon as it's gone public, we've had friends of his, we've had people who knew him really well, people in the art world are feeding back to us experiences and meeting him. So the next few months, I think, for us are going to be a real process of learning about him.
And you say that some of the prices are not extraordinary. What's the kind of price range that's being placed on the arts? What's the value in just estimations of the collection?
At the moment, the low estimate for sales around £10 million. But we've got things that start at £200, £300. Some of the Memphis design objects start off at that level. Bowie wasn't hierarchical in the way he collected. He just bought things that he liked. So he wasn't, I need the best of this, the best of that. He was interested in all sorts of things. So there's going to be a lot in there that's going to be in the £500 to £4,000 range, which is definitely affordable.
Yeah, that's a nice kind of, there's a nice biographical detail there as well, actually. I like the fact that I'm unsurprised, actually, that there are what you might call ordinary things or inexpensive things in this collection. Bowie was sort of, you know, he was such an artist, but he was such an ordinary man in so many ways as well. And I think those two things were always slightly fighting, you know, to come out on top, actually, in interviews, in the way that he worked and all the rest of it. Huge work ethic, but also kind of a creator on crazy flights of fancy. It's nice that this is sort of recognised in this collection. Does it feel, people are still, a lot of people, as we said in the introduction, are sort of reeling from the sadness of such a shocking sudden death. Do you feel kind of lucky to be in the aura of some of these pieces that sat in, whether they're in storage or in his apartment in New York, that there's some sort of something attached of Bowie to them?
Yeah, no, this sells, it's, I don't know, it sounds like a cliche, but it's a real privilege to work on a collection like this as a collection. It's not just a couple of pieces. You'll really get learning about him, how creative he was, how, as a collector, especially somebody collecting the stuff that I do, the stuff that I love, for him to have taken so much care over 20th century British art and really, really learnt about it, it's fantastic.
Can I ask you, you know, not just with this sale, but the broader collection question, which is fascinating that, you know, we were talking earlier on that, you know, it's well known, it's the three Ds that bring you the big collections, death, divorce and debt. And here we have a death. But what's fascinating for outsiders of the art world is, you know, here we are, only many months after his death, something he was passionate about bringing together and collecting. And you will, by necessity for his family, for the art world, you will now spread it back to the winds. Is there sometimes a little feeling of, you know, you hope that these things go to good homes? You hope that there is... Do you feel any sense of when collections get broken up? Is there any emotional feeling for you as well?
Yeah, I think so. And I think they will go to good homes because it's not a flashy collection. It's not a trophy collection. These things are obscure because they're not fashionable. And we love the fact that some of these artists might be rescued from obscurity because people are looking and go, wow, God, David Bowie like them, then these guys are definitely worth researching. It's really important for us in doing the sale that we're going to make sure that the catalogues are not quite works of art in themselves, but that they're very serious, they're very academic, they have a depth that we think he will appreciate. The way that we're organising the sale is that it's not just going to be the most expensive things here and then the cheaper things there. We're going to weave things in and try and capture some of the texture that he created and keep that. So we'd like the auction catalogue itself to become...
That's going to be a beautiful thing. Yeah.
And the actual auction will be in London or in New York?
In London. He's a British guy. It's a mainly British collection. Obviously, there's, we know, works by international artists too, but we felt it was really appropriate for it to be sold in London.
Just finally, the 400 works have been consigned. The collection is there. We know where it is. It's all got tabs on it. The auction catalogue has been written up. If there are only 399 bits come sale night and one piece was hanging over the mantelpiece in the Hucker household, which one would it be, Simon?
That all kind of changes on a daily basis. When you live with these things, you swap a little bit. I think it will be Witness by Peter Lanyon, painted in 1961. It's a great example of post-war British abstraction, yet it's the kind of picture that would hold its own in a room full of American painting that's worth $30, $40 million each. So it's really exemplary of how British painters can reach the real sort of top level. And it's beautiful as well.
And possibly a bit of homesickness on the part of David Bowie in some of this collection, I think, somehow. At the time he collected it as well.
Yeah. I think because he's spending a lot of time in outside Manhattan, the UK and he's going from Switzerland and onto Manhattan. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also looking at where he came from and it's about his self-identity.
Check him on the way out. It's Simon Hucker with a suspiciously rectangular form under his arm. Simon, thank you very much for talking us through the show. And that is on when this travelling exhibition happens. But I guess it's, what is it, the 8th of November, the actual sale?
It's on the 10th and the 11th.
10th and 11th.
And the preview exhibition is from the 1st and until the 10th. So.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for talking us through it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Time for the music now. This new from Baltimore musician Jen Wasner, known for her work in the band Y Oak. But this is her going solo as Flock of Dimes with Semaphore. If simple habit added tale to tale, and if the wires could reveal themselves, we could begin to trace the ins and outs, the horizon of our lingering uncertainty. The voice across the waves agrees with me. We pay very high price to be free, and I wonder if it's enough.
That was A Flock of Dimes from Baltimore with Semaphore. And you're listening to Monocle Weekly, and it's on Monocle 24.
Ali McGregor is an Australian cabaret singer whose solo show Alchemy is taking place at the London Wonderground location on London's South Bank this Tuesday. Ali's show interprets the pop hits we know and love into an evening of more sultry and provocative jazz and drama. And we'll be talking about just that in a moment.
But Ali is a multi-talented performer, and as well as the cabaret, one of her other calling cards is opera. She's performed everywhere, from the West End to the Sydney Opera House, no less. And she joins us now to tell us more about how she combines influences such as opera, cabaret and good old-fashioned pop into her performances. Ali, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. We should start. How come you do so many things? What was your background? Was your training as an opera singer and then you wanted to kind of reach a different audience? How did you come to this?
Yeah, a little bit of that. I did train as an opera singer. I trained at the Royal Northern College of Music in the UK, in Manchester. And then I went back and I sang with Opera Australia for about 6 years. I never intended to be an opera singer, though. I loved jazz. I loved trashy pop music. I didn't want to be a pop singer, but I loved jazz. And then I did fall into it a little bit. I auditioned for an opera course, got in, really started enjoying it. I've always loved being on stage. I loved acting, and opera had the ability to sort of become a character as well. So I felt like I could do both things. I could act and sing. So opera kind of grew on me. And then And then I ran away with the circus, quite literally. There's a show that you may be familiar with, La Soirée, yes. That's played many seasons here. At the beginning of its life, it was called La Clique, and it was born in a Spiegel tent in Melbourne, outside the Victorian Arts Centre, which is our opera house in Melbourne. And one night I was, after the opera, I came out and I sort of wandered in there not knowing what on earth it was, and was taken into this sort of other world. And I hadn't really seen, cabaret to me was something that was really naff and sung in piano bars, and I'd never experienced that kind of visceral. And cabaret was, at the time, this is sort of 12 years ago, was having this resurgence and sort of coming back in with all these wonderful kind of carnies coming off, you know, street performers and burlesque dancers and singers all coming and converging in these little tents and little venues. And I'd heard this, had been singing at Wilton's Music Hall before I left the UK, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Wilton's.
Yeah.
And I did a show there, which was the first show when it was transformed into an old rag warehouse into a theatre. And working with Jonathan Miller, the wonderful director, and he told us this story of these opera singers from Covent Garden who, in the sort of mid-1800s, who after their opera, they'd take off their outer clothes, keep their corsets and petticoats, hop in a carriage, go to Wilton's and sing their arias for the music hall audience and have money thrown at them and probably made more than they did as chorus girls at Covent Garden. And I always just had this image in my mind and thought it was such a wonderful thing of kind of breaking down that fourth wall and bringing opera, you know, to the people, for want of a less pretentious way of explaining it. This is always in the back of my mind. And I ended up having a conversation with the guy who ran this Spiegel tent, and I told him this story, and he said, well, why don't you do that here? So I did. I was singing.
Now I know why you're dressed like this. You've gone full Stanislavski.
Exactly. So I was doing Manon, Massenet's Manon, and after the third act, I wasn't in the fourth act, and I had these wonderful costumes, and so I got four of the chorus to come and help me, and I had the props guys help me make this shell. I ended up doing this spot in the late night Spiegel tent after the opera as sort of Venus coming out of the shell singing an aria. And I was so, and this was in the middle of, I think there'd been a sword swallower directly before me, and there was tap dancers and you know, a jazz band playing, and I sang this aria. And I was just completely transfixed. And then I ended up joining their show, La Clique, and travelling the world with them, and I really did run away with the circus. I never kind of looked back. I've done bits and pieces of opera since then, but it was such a direct way of communicating with people, and it was just so much fun.
And this is presumably the thing that we said, that you work in opera, you work in cabaret, you work in pop, and you fuse all these things together, which is very nice and very rare not to be snobbish about genres, because everybody loves to put people are put in a box and people kind of then operate within that box. I guess all of this stuff at some point has been and is pop music, right? So
you can treat
all these imposters just the same.
Absolutely. I think a good song is a good song. It doesn't matter what genre it is. And I think the test of a good song is that you can sing it in any style and it will still work. I mean, Summertime by Gershwin is a perfect example. I mean, it's from what is essentially an opera, but I have heard that song sung so many different ways, you know, from jazz bands and sort of, you know, electro lounge, and I've even heard rock bands do it. It's a really versatile song. And that's what I love. You know, we get very pretentious about music. I did a show looking at the American Songbook, and we're looking particular at Irving Berlin. And at the time, you know, we think of him now as, we sort of hold him up as being a, you know, American Songbook standard composer. But at the time, he was Tin Pan Alley. He wrote 1,500 songs. He would just write a song a day. They were trashy pop songs. So I loved the idea of looking at some of the trashy pop that I loved in the 80s and 90s and wondering what in later on in my lifetime we will look back and think of Britney's Oops, I Did It Again, and think of that as a classic. All these songs that Max Martin, you know, pumps out at a great rate. He'll probably be held up as a sort of Irving Berlin of our day.
Dennis, the Verdi of the 80s.
Look, right? You never know.
Exactly,
never know.
Exactly.
And tell me, with Wonderground, it's pop songs, but how do you bring that to life? We said there's a hint of drama, there's a hint of cabaret. How do you bring it to life for a London audience?
Well, the idea for me was turning trash into treasure. So taking these sort of trashy pop songs that people may have dismissed, and through the art of jazz, I have a really fantastic jazz trio playing behind me, and we don't dumb down the music at all. We sort of look at them as, you know, just individual songs, individual stories, and we bring something to them. And look, I have a bit of fun with them. So I do a version of Aqua's Barbie Girl, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Beautiful, beautiful song. And I actually get my band to play Making Whoopee, which is a lovely jazz standard. And then I sing Barbie Girl as this, you know, a beautiful, you know, sort of love song, jazzy love song. I do get a call from Ken in the middle of it. So that does turn. We have a saying. I'm not sure what your language restrictions are here at Monocle, but we have a saying in Australia, which is you can't polish a turd, but you can roll it in glitter. So
that seems like the basis of much cabaret. We should define
that. Is the basis of my career.
How do we define cabaret? Because you said, you know, 10 years ago it was suddenly hot again, and there are so many venues in London which have popped up. There's a burlesque thing happened at the sort of same time. It's not clearly the same thing, but they're sort of sisters, aren't they?
They are, yeah. Well, I'm artistic.
How do we define cabaret then, I wonder?
Well, I get asked this. I'm artistic director or co-artistic director of the Adelaide Cabaret Festival, which is the biggest cabaret festival
in the
world.
You've got the meaning tattooed on your wrist.
Kind of, yeah. And so we do get asked this question a huge amount. And look, it's kind of different things to different people. And cabaret essentially is the venue, not the art. Although it has now become, you know, a title for the genre. But cabaret was always intimate. And I think for me that is where it's at. It has to have an intimacy. Now, at the Adelaide Cabaret Festival, it's a huge festival. We had sort of 42,000 people. We had Dita Von Teese headlining it this year. And wonderful singers like Barb Junger, who you'll know, I'm sure, you know, British cabaret royalty. And the idea, we have one venue that's got 2,000 seats. So you sort of think, how do you create intimacy in there? And that for us was the challenge. And we had to make sure that no matter how big the act is, it had to feel intimate. And for me as well, I think cabaret is this genre that other standard genres just don't cover it. So music, dance, theatre, the cabaret for me is in between the cracks of these genres. So
it's
not just a music,
well. Yeah.
It's not just a music gig. It's got something else. It has a bit of drama, it has a bit of theatre, or it has a bit of dance. So burlesque for me, you know, and also comedy as well. There's always, you know, a comic element, always, but it's not just stand-up comedy, but maybe it has a comic element and musical songs. So for me it is between the cracks, but it has to have an intimacy.
Some place also where you can, where when you're in the audience, you're sort of meant to drink in the audience, but you also get to drink out of a glass made of glass. That seems to be something that sets the genre apart from every other type of music.
Absolutely, like, absolutely. Yeah. But I think also the thing about cabaret is the audience has a really big part of the action. I think,
yeah, they know their side of the contract, right?
Yeah. And every night as a performer, every night is different because the audience is different, and it's a kind of dialogue between audience performer. There's rarely a fourth wall in cabaret, and meaning that, you know, that the person on stage is quite sometimes quite literally talking to the audience, but there is a conversation going on no matter what. There's an implicit sort of a deal made, I think, that you're a part of it, and therefore that intimacy is created, and people relate to the stories much more when they feel that they're being talked to, having conversation with, rather than just being sung at.
Now, Ali, we mentioned to you before you came in that maybe we have a kind of a young student for you in the room in the shape of Robert Bound, because yes. he's a pretty good singer. And when we go out of an evening, actually, there's an amazing pub around here where of an evening they have a piano player. And when the piano player sees Rob arrive, you can see his eyes light up because he knows that there is somebody.
Everyone else leaves.
They know that somebody will be leading them, whether it's in the Pet Shop Boys or Roll Out the Barrel. He will be next to the piano for the rest of the evening and cajoling the rest of the. But we thought maybe he could improve his skills slightly. And you said you may have a lesson for him.
Well, look, I'm interested to know. I do this thing called whistle tone. I'm a little obsessed with this 1950s Peruvian singer called Ema Sumac, and I'm writing a show about her. And I've been listening to her music for a very long time, and she does a thing called whistle tone. And Mariah Carey does it as well. You'll know it, the very, very high note.
It's like we could think of it as like trilling on those top notes, right?
Sort of, yeah, yeah. It's actually a different. It's not singing exactly. It's a little bit more like whistling through your throat. And just to demonstrate,
I feel a cough coming on already.
Just to demonstrate, you mean. It. So that's Whistletone.
Where's that coming from?
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So I wondered, and it's a sound we can all make, because if you think, have you ever, Anna, look, you gentlemen are exceedingly masculine, I can tell, but I'm sure that there has been a time in your life where you've received a little fright and there's just been a little... A little squeal that has emitted, yeah.
Okay.
So can you do a little squeal?
Oh. Mm. It's a little bit low, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's a little bit low. I need to go a bit higher.
Yeah, you're almost getting that, but you're actually singing.
I'm kind of singing, aren't I?
Yeah.
I'm
trying to... It's the sort of noise that you make as you fright, when you get a fright.
I need
and
to
you
be shocked. I need to be shocked. I need to sort of like... See, I'm sort of seeing it. It's coming out of my larynx, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not coming out of.
You can't.
Who knows
you can't.
Where else
you can't. You can't help it. Maybe Andrew should try.
Right?
I hear that you tend to veer towards the Mick Jagger and karaoke. So I think maybe you just can't help but they can't try, help but try it. Maybe, well, Andrew, why don't
you
try
it? Yeah, you can try.
No, I can't do it. It's really from low down in your. This is going to brand me for life. Here we go.
Oh,
that's really good.
Lord, that is
really
good.
That's different. That's better.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think maybe we've got this. I was told no. One of you doesn't want to sing.
Yeah.
One of you wants to sing.
I'm just gonna note though.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Well, that's good.
And then what happens after you've done that?
Well, you just have to try and make a tune out of it.
Okay. Well, we'll do.
Come on, Andrew.
We need to go back to that. I'm doing what you're doing.
That's actually pretty good.
Yeah,
I reckon you've got the makings of a...
This is good, isn't it?
Remarkably good.
This is really good. That is really good.
No, this is the whole point of this. For once, it wasn't me in the hot seat.
I don't know how I managed to get away with it.
I'm both hot and in the seat.
I'm thinking next karaoke night, you get A-ha's Take On Me.
Okay. Yeah.
You start the song, and then just when it goes up a notch, you can take
okay,
the...
Okay, Bobby B. I'll be there next
Have you got a deal?
Song.
Have you got a deal?
I've got a deal.
That's it. That is it. That's what we need.
Finally, I have a role at karaoke.
Hey, there you go.
Thank you, Andrew, for taking the heat there. we're a good double act, though. I mean, I think you're right. We could go from Morton Harkett to whoever the whistle tone section of that song is.
Well, I think it's still him.
Yeah.
He just has a very big range.
He's just got a big...
Yeah. So two men have to take the place of one Morgan.
There you go, Andrew. Big range.
Big range. Yeah. We'll sort it.
Ali, thank you very much for coming in, teaching us whistle tone and talking us through the highs and lows of it all. And telling us all about how fun it sounded like it was to run away and join the circus, and it's become a fantastic career. Well, what we need to talk about the show as well.
Yeah, we should point out that Ali McGregor is, of course, performing Alchemy at London Wonderground, and that's on London's South Bank, and it's this Tuesday. Make sure you're there.
Are you going to be doing? You going to be doing any requests afterwards, Andrew?
I think I shall be staying well away from the stage. But thank you, Ali.
My pleasure.
We end today's show looking at a couple of our favourite things, a bit of art and some good food and drink to go with it. The University of the Arts in London has set students from its school, the London College of Communication, the quite pleasant challenge of bringing to life the culinary values of the Rhône region in France. And they're doing it with the help of a pop-up restaurant by award-winning chef Adam Rawson. The exhibition, it's called The Rhône Touch, is currently at the University of the Arts Central St Martin's campus.
Each artwork engages guests via a different sensorial experience, ranging from sound to smell to touch. The exhibition's curator is Joel Karamath, who's course director in Interaction Design Arts for UAL. And Joel joins us now, along with the chef Adam Rawson, to tell us where food, wine and art meet. Gentlemen, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for having us.
First things first, let's talk about the big things that flow out of this discussion. How good was your opening party?
Absolutely superb.
Good. I thought it might have had some rocket fuel. Yeah. Okay, so who misbehaved? Who came out of it, out of the two of you, with flying colours? Who has a letter of apology to write to Central St Martin's where it was held?
I think both of us on both those questions, actually.
Okay,
probably a lot of apologies need to be made, but all for the right reasons, I would thought, from my point of view.
Sounds good. And it's one of those things, obviously, you are trying to, as we said in the queue, embody a region of France, the Côte d'Aron, which is all those wonderful... wonderful food and wine in a show that sort of fuses art and presumably also was serving some of this stuff at the opening. What's your kind of opening remit for that? Maybe we'll come to you first, Joel. Like, what do you have in your head when you get a commission like that? An instant kind of go-to way of kind of explaining a region through artifacts and scents and smells.
Yeah, I think, you know, any artifact is always a product of a given culture. Uh-huh. And that's our first point with the students is like, okay, this product, where does it come from? Why does it represent the place it comes from? How does it represent the place it comes from? How do you interpret that? And so that was really our starting point with this, is about an interpretive aspect of the exhibition.
And Adam, you've brought this to life as a restaurant. You have a great track record here in London. You've had many hit restaurants. What was your kind of your interaction with this, and how did you want to bring it to life?
I mean, the Côte d'Ivoire didn't want to do any French food. They didn't want it to be too rich, or they wanted to have a lot of influence from all around the world. So luckily, with all my travels, I've sourced so many ingredients from around the world, including some dashi from Japan, amazing beef from Spain. And
is this because they didn't want it to be seen as, you know, you have to drink French wine with French food?
Absolutely. I think they wanted to show that the wines are so diverse and they can be paired with almost anything. And the wines actually on offer are incredible. And you'd be very surprised to find anything like that in London for less than 100 quid a bottle. Definitely not by the glass. And so, yeah, I mean, pairing the foods has been a pleasure for me as well. And when I do pair the food with the wines, I just make sure that it's not too complicated and the quality of the ingredients are...
And before we bring Joel back in, I guess that's the interesting thing for lots of French wine regions, you know, that they are perhaps seen as a bit traditional in some senses, and they're coming to a chef like you, mixing up the kinds of foods they can be drunk with, even the kinds of people perhaps they meet in the establishment that you've kind of set up. Is that what you're kind of also trying to help them do? Say, look, they're not kind of just boring French regional wine producers. They're doing something exciting, and here's how we can help you a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think French wine has become one of those old world wines now where people kind of just pair them with simple French food or, you know, very simple food that's very simply done. For me, it's more about creating my food with loads of flavours and to showcase the wine that can actually work together, even if it's a ceviche that's a South American dish, and pairing that with a French wine, and it's working really well.
Yeah, I wonder what you say on that, actually, because I quite like to, you know, we're taught that things should go with each other.
Yeah.
What about things when things purposely don't? I mean, there's a great joy in having something that's not meant to go with something, and it brings out the flavour of both.
Absolutely. I mean, there's one of the dishes that I've got, and it's a ceviche with yuzu, galangal, and pink peppercorns.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going to be paired with a rosé. And normally, you'd go for a white wine, typically, but the rosé just works perfectly with a pink peppercorn. And it's just been a real amazing experience for me as well to taste French wines in a different way as well.
Rosie sadly goes with anything, even breakfast. Andrew Tuck can tell you all about that.
Joel, can I ask you, is it asking almost the same question in a way, when people come to you with these projects, when outside organisations say, can we knock on your door and have a word? They're coming with a small issue that they want resolved in a way. So what was it that they thought that your students could do that they would be able to deliver for the wines?
I think when Coke came to us, the thing that I was really pleased with, they were really open. And very often you get outside collaborations and they come in, oh, we want you to do this. They looked at the projects we had done previously and they were really open for us to interpret the wine. And I think to sort of echo Adam's sort of saying, it's about exploring the new. Just because you have something that has an age-old tradition and is very well thought of doesn't mean to say you can't look at it in a new light. And similarly, just because there's connoisseurship around something doesn't mean to say you can't pair that with a playful attitude to something. And I think that's something we try and push our students to do anyway. There's got to be a connoisseurship in design aspects anyway. You've got to learn your product, you've got to learn your subject matter. And that to me is a connoisseurship as well. And so similarly, if that exists in wine, it's about then getting the students to explore the new through that. It's about looking at established things through new eyes.
So we should just list a few of the things. There's a a wine bottle sound system.
Yeah.
I really like the grapes that you can crush as yeah. well, a digital experience of grape crushing. There's a chair that is a kind of, well, it gives us all, it touches all the senses. And it's just, again, amazing. So when you then see the work of the students and you're obviously judging them in a certain sense, what to you was essential to bring? You know, because you don't want to just bring to life wine in a way, you want to bring this region to life as well. So what kind of elements were you looking for in the kind of the best of the design?
Well, I think when you're looking at things such as like regions, one of the projects produced a series of chairs, one each, I think three chairs, each one kind of focused on an individual wine, and they came up with aromas that went along that, the classic aromas that are associated with those wines. And one of the things they started looking at was what makes a wine region different from another wine region. So they started to look at things like the type of soil that is predominant in the Côte d'Aron region, why that's different from soils growing the same grape anywhere else, and how that affects the grape. So if you know you've got a lot more things like quartz, etc., you get a lot more reflections from the sun, so therefore it keeps the grapes warmer at certain times. You know, so they started to look at things like that. So aspects of the region actually went down to sort of like geological aspects as well that the students started to
People
look
love
into.
To know this stuff, you see. Yeah. I think this is fascinating because all this stuff makes a difference to how that grape works in that terroir, I suppose, and then what that wine tastes like. It's a really interesting client, I suppose, or it's a really interesting benefactor to work with here, the Côte d'Aron region, because French wines have, as Andrew was sort of alluding to earlier, have been really bad at branding themselves. They have the famous Chateau and those wonderful wines and that wonderful history, but you know, Australia came along and was so good at branding it. You know, there are wines called Fat Bastard and things, whatever you think of that, it sticks in people's mind. People walk into what is probably predominantly a supermarket for most people buying their wine, and these things jump off the shelves at them. They're friendly brands. So there's something in terms of that. I wonder whether there is extra work that's ticking away in the back of both of your minds about rebranding French wine to be something a little more friendly. Joel, maybe you'd like to answer first.
I wouldn't say so much it's about a rebranding. I'd say it's much more about breaking down barriers that exist already, and the whole idea of, you know, just something is seen as like haute cuisine, etc., that you shouldn't enjoy it, and what circumstances you enjoy that under are just being broadened, I think. And I think that was really key to the way we were looking at it. And I think
I was just going
to
get you your next job there.
Yeah. Adam, maybe you could come here. When you're, you know, thinking about the food, how much of a say do you have over the drinks and the wine that are going to be stocked and stored and served in your restaurants? Are you intrigued to kind of get involved in that world that, you know, some restaurants leave just to the sommelier and the chefs don't really kind of seem to get that involved with them?
No, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's quite important to definitely have an amazing wine list. Not just of the reputation of the wine, but more how you feel about that wine yourself as, you know, an organisation. If you think that the wine is amazing, you just get it on the list. My last job, I had a big influence on the menu. I've got a friend of mine, Joanna, and she helps me set up my wines for my pop-ups. And even in my last travels, I go to wineries. I've been to 6 or 7 wineries in the past couple of months in Croatia, Italy. And it's just been such a great experience learning more about wine as a chef.
We should be quizzing you a little bit. What's happening with your career at the moment? Because you had a huge hit with Pachamama. You've been doing like Peruvian Anglo food. You've been doing all sorts of things. Where are you at the moment?
Well, now, after
you're thinking of it, you're working on a flag.
Well, after I left Pachamama, I decided to go on a year-long, maybe even 2 years, hopefully.
Wine tasting course.
No, travelling around Europe and hopefully beyond next year. Going to countries that are very well known for their food and just to discover more about the traditions and culture of the food itself in those countries. So I've been to Piemonte, Croatia, the Basque Country, Morocco, Sardinia,
And is this about
Barcelona?
Stretching yourself as a chef? Or
absolutely. I mean, for me, it's redefining the way I cook now. I mean, I'm learning so much when I go away about the amazing ingredients that I find. And really, I'm making so many connections that when I do get a restaurant in the future, I've got those people that I met on these travels to supply me with these ingredients that you would not find in London. And it's been an amazing trip so far, and so I've still got another 4, maybe 5 countries to do this year. And it's really just an incredible experience, and it's a chef's dream to be able to go and to go to these countries, but then to fill a suitcase full of ingredients, come back to London to do pop-ups. and people are loving him so far. So
tell me that, you know, that pop-up scene. You know, we've covered it a lot here at Monocle. It seems to be a really intriguing way for people to get involved in the business of food. All sorts of people getting involved in it. But for you, what's the appeal of the pop-up?
For me, the appeal of pop-up is really not to... I mean, I wanted to get out of the kitchen. I mean, I've been working in the kitchen for 10, 11 years now. And I wanted to get out to almost take a step back and to really think about the way I want to cook in my restaurant in the future. And for me, the way I've been cooking, and especially since Passion Mama, is I really want to learn more about the international flavours and food done internationally. So to go away on these travels and to learn more about that, you know, it's really helping to shape the way I cook now.
Do you learn about, I mean, also presumably with pop-ups, you know, you're closer to the paying customer, the punter. That's very important, isn't it? To see who's eating it, to see what they're talking about. And also, to we've been talking about breaking down barriers and making this stuff a little bit more informal. That's part and parcel of it. So you're not downstairs in the basement slaving
away. Absolutely, but as well with pop-ups is like, when you come to a pop-up, you know that the person cooking it is the chef behind the stove. When you go to restaurants, you've got maybe 8 or 9 chefs cooking the food that the chef wants them to cook, but the chef is not physically cooking everything himself. And I take all the food out to the customers, I explain the dishes, I explain where I got the ingredients from, and I really take them on a journey as well through my travels.
And Joel, tell us, people coming through London, how can they dive into the exhibition, and Adam, how can they get to the restaurant? What's its lifespan?
Its lifespan, it's going to go on until the 31st of July. So it's going to be an event that's run across that. I think it's closed on the 25th for one day in the middle of the week.
And Adam, we need to make sure that people get to eat the food as well. Just tell us how people get to do that as well.
Well, the tickets are available on Eventbrite. Just look for the Rhone Touch. £49, so you get to try 10 dishes paired with 3 amazing wines. And there's also a burger and ceviche bar, and they're priced at £5 each. So really a bargain all the way around.
Brilliant. Well, we'll certainly be down there, Rob.
See you at the bar, Andrew.
Brilliant.
Joel and Adam, thank you very much for
joining us. Thank you very much for having us.
£368 editions of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew. Don't mind if I do. There we have it.
What year did the Monocle Weekly start?
1942.
No. That's the year you invented the shoe.
Yeah. No. What about 1944? Someone invented the floor.
That's right. That's someone else's sketch.
Exactly.
Not that.
But if you type that
sketch
into Google, do you think that George Dawes will come up?
I hope so.
Do you think taking the table will come up? Do you remember?
Yes.
Phil come all the way from Rochester to take the table, and I've beaten him too. He's had a wasted journey.
Should we just repeat other people's TV show?
No one knows what we're talking about.
A rant.
But that's fine. Because we've had such a successful, wonderful show with 3 beautiful guests, actually 6, because everyone came in 2s, didn't they, today, we can just round out the show, I reckon.
Let's do it.
Should we thank our friends behind the glass?
I'm going to thank, first of all, Tom Hall, who is our producer.
And I'm going to thank our researcher, who was Jacob Leidener, and Patrick Hunt. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back, of course, same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.